It is tough to see a friend or, say, a brother in a tight spot, but what if the tight spots are news and you're a newscaster with a big platform and a high-profile salary to match? You could ask Chris Cuomo or maybe his former CNN colleague Don Lemon. They've got some stories to tell this week, and we've got one tonight. Plus, Merry Christmas! You are fired. Mortgage company Better.com lays off hundreds of workers on a Zoom just weeks before Christmas. Is there any circumstance where this might be fair game? And then, Brooke Shields. Back then, maybe nothing got between her and her Calvins, but today, something has definitely gotten under her skin. And hear what the legendary anchor Gayle King said about keeping her cool when R. Kelly lost his. Words of wisdom from a legendary mentor. All ahead on Banfield. Hello and welcome to Banfield. The testimony is over in the Chicago trial of actor and musician Jussie Smollett. It's been almost 3 years since he claimed to be the victim of a racist and homophobic street crime, only to wind up under arrest himself for allegedly staging the whole thing. Several plot twists later, he's standing trial on half a dozen counts of felony disorderly conduct, i.e. lying to the police. And he spent much of the last 2 days on the witness stand. He admitted to a prior relationship with the two brothers who he still insists attacked him and who testified against him during trial. But now he says they roughed him up to try to force him to hire them as his bodyguards. Okay, yep, I know. Sounds pretty weird to me too. Closing arguments set for tomorrow. Maybe it'll sound less weird when the jury hears it all in narrative form. But, and that's a big but, Smollett said something else on the witness stand. And it struck a nerve. And this case has struck a lot of nerves, right and left, from the outset. He said early on that CNN anchor Don Lemon, who is a friend of his, told him that Chicago police weren't buying his story. Now, that's not exactly a state secret. Now, maybe this doesn't mean much of anything, of anyone or anything. I don't know, ethics-wise, otherwise. But there are two things to think about. First, Lemon has been reporting on the Smollett trial from day one. He even did a segment on it last night. But he didn't say anything. He didn't mention at all anything about his own name coming up in court during testimony from the defendant himself on the stand. That's weird. Second, this comes not even a week after another primetime anchor got fired under similar ethics questions, but also some sex allegations from a former colleague. His former network, ABC, seems to be where some of the issues are stemming. Chris Cuomo lost his CNN show. He lost a multi-million dollar contract, in part for allegedly misleading his bosses about the lengths to which he tried to help his brother survive the sexual harassment scandal. And you'll, of course, remember his brother is the former New York governor, Andrew Cuomo. So I should point out at this stage of the game that both Don Lemon and Chris Cuomo were former colleagues of mine. Don Lemon, a friend as well as a colleague, friend for 20 years. But I do think it's important to talk about boundaries and transparency, and I dare say trust in a profession, mine, that has long been lacking in all of them. And the guy on the right-hand side of your screen is Subbu Vincent. He's the director of journalism and media ethics, the program at Santa Clara University. So, thank you so much for being with me tonight. I just want to get your reaction right off the bat to the fact that Don Lemon's name was raised on the witness stand as being somebody who Jussie Smollett heard from and was getting a bit of counsel on this case, all at the same time that Don Lemon is covering this story. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, Melissa, thank you. Actually, thank you for actually having me on this on your show. It actually caught me by surprise completely. When you hear about a CNN anchor about a TV anchor reporting on a case, when you see that name jump out of trial proceedings, it is a big surprise. But what really got me particularly worried was the sequence of events that leads up to this. The fact that Don Lemon actually released information about what the police thought about Jussie Smollett's claims to Jussie himself before he might have covered it for the public. That is a fundamental conflict of interest. And it goes back to the whole ethics of having a relationship with somebody, with a individual that you also are reporting on, and it's not just disclosure. Yes, there is a fundamental disclosure question here. There's also a conflict of interest issue, but I would place it at a higher question of privilege. As a reporter, I have power to report to the public a bunch of facts. I also have power to relay to a person, a source, a person who is a person of interest in the investigation, who started out as a victim and now there's confusion. The police have accused him. Given that kind of situation, I would have asked for, ethics requires anticipation and then either recusal or at least taking the call, going public with what he knew in the form of an actual story, and let Jussie Smollett learn about the police's doubts through a story.
So can I ask you this? What's hard here is that I'm imagining all of the students you teach, and the game is changing so fast, right? I'm sure syllabuses from 5 years ago are gone, 10 years ago burned. But at the same time, we're still journalists and we still have to have that wall between the subjects we cover. However, we have to also book guests. We also have to create relationships with these potential guests. These big interviews don't come out of thin air. The Jussie Smollett's of the world are not going to sit down with a stranger. They're going to sit down with a Don Lemon. So how does Don Lemon curate that relationship and still walk that very tight, tightrope?
I think it's absolutely possible to covered the case, to even interview Jussie and all of those things. But when there's a material fact of an actual investigation that is emerging to a reporter or to the reporting team, you got to ask yourself whether a person of interest in the investigation gets to hear that first from you under the, you know, behind the scenes, or whether it should go out to the story first, because a reporter's first responsibility is to the public. That's the ethical call there. And if you don't do that, then that can lead to the kind of down-the-line consequence that happened, where Jussie Smollett decided not to turn over his records to the police. So it is a judgment call. But I think it's hard for one person to have the relationship with somebody. And I agree with you, it's important to have these relationships because you're going to bring people on the show. But you've got to take the call on who can take that call. Can you, as the anchor, take the call on whether to give that bit of information ahead of time to a particular person of interest in the investigation or not? I would say it's first of all not Don Lemon's decision to take that kind of call. It should have been discussed in a team, in a room, in the newsroom. Maybe ethics counsel could have been asked about it, and also it would have been upfront. If let's say he took the call actively, it would have been good to say that.
Well,
on
it's
the story
a wake
itself.
Up call. You know what? It's a wake up call for, I think, journalists everywhere that if you're going to try to curate relationships with people that you're going to cover, you've got to be very aware that these are the pratfalls. Subbu Vincent, thank you. Thank you so much for taking the time. And I wish I could sit in your class one day and hear what it is that the kids are learning these days, because, man, the game is different. Thanks again.
Yeah, thank you, Ashley.
At 15 years old in 1980, Brooke Shields was one of the most famous supermodels in the world. She graced almost every magazine cover. She was the face and the body behind Calvin Klein jeans, and fame meant media, a lot of media. And in a recent interview with Dax Shepard for his podcast Armchair Expert, Brooke said that this about the 1980s interview she did with Barbara Walters.
Uh-huh. I've recently had to go back and look at all of my footage and appearances and Tonight Shows and Barbara Walters. And
that Barbara Walters interview is maddening.
Oh, with Britney?
No, with Brooke.
With me. Oh, well, it's practically criminal.
Like, it is.
It is not journalism.
I'm actually not trying to skewer Barbara Walters. She was also living in 1980.
There's jealousy. There's anger. It's such a difficult thing to really decipher.
That's a lot to decipher. So joining me now is supermodel, actress, and writer Paulina Poroskova, who herself was in the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue at age 17, on the cover at 18, and on thousands and thousands of covers after that. Paulina, thanks for being with me. I wanted to get your reaction to what Brooke said about what she went through at that age.
Yeah, well, you know, I did start modeling when I was 15, too. And I was by myself in Paris at 15. So I do sort of know what she's talking about, and I don't think that she's wrong. In a funny way, the fact that Brooke was doing what she was doing at her age is, you know, we're the same age. I'm 56 as well. And it made it okay for me to be in Paris and model at 15 because Brooke Shields was doing it.
Right. It makes sense. I want to play that moment in the Barbara Walters interview from back in 1980, because I remember it ruffled a few feathers back then. And there's Brooke talking about looking back on it now and having the feelings that she has. So here she is. She's with her mom during the Barbara Walters interview. Take a look.
Brooke, what are your measurements?
I'm 5'10". And 120.
I think when people see you, they don't realize how tall and slim you are. Let me stand up with you, because I'm 5'5", and I'm wearing high heels.
Would you be a mother like your mother?
I think so, yes. I mean, I think I've learned from my mom, you know.
But what about the people who say she had no childhood? And accuse you. You took away her childhood.
But I'm still going through my childhood, so I can't say that I didn't.
Sitting here like this is going through your childhood?
Paulina, it's hard watching that now in the climate we live in now. That was a 15-year-old kid. That wasn't some 25-year-old model. She might have looked it, but she was 15.
And she, boy, what a beautiful 15, too. But that doesn't make it okay to have been put in the position that she was put in. See, to me, the interesting part there is that her mom is sitting right next to her. So
yeah.
Obviously... it was her mom. I mean, a 15-year-old is a child, right? And you have parents for a reason. If you want pizza every day, your parent is there to tell you that's not a good idea. So here was the mom, I guess, managing and making all of this happen for her little girl. And I wonder what she was thinking, because. I mean, can you imagine as a mother sending your 15-year-old out and the Calvin Klein ads with the jeans? I mean, that's sexualizing a child.
So I'll tell you what, it's hard. The video is so blurry now, so many years later, but you could almost see Brooke's mom wince at that question. Like, would you want a mother like that? Like, felt really uncomfortable. But they should have been separated. If she wanted to do a tough interview with the mom, that's different, but not with the girl. Okay, so this next little piece of tape I want to show you is the Mike Douglas Show. And this is what happened when Brooke Shields came out on the Mike Douglas Show. And let's just remember, as you watch this is a 15-year-old girl being welcomed onto a show. Take a peek.
So please welcome Brooke Shields.
You are an exquisite looking young lady. Isn't she a beautiful young lady?
So I suppose you could look at that two ways, depending on your age, right? If you're over 50, you'd say, what's wrong with that? And if you're under 50, you'd say, did he just say oof about that exquisite looking 15-year-old?
Yeah, well, boy, that, you know what? That's a really big bag to unpack. I think it's the first time that I can remember that a 15-year-old really was sexualized like Brooke. But even today, the women that are idealized all look like very young girls. They might not be, you know, 15 anymore, but you're still supposed to look 15 to be considered beautiful, or 17. Yeah. I don't know if that makes a big difference. But what do you think?
Well, you know, it's, I think we, you know, we're all looking at things through a different lens. And I, like Dax Shepard, I don't want to beat up on Barbara Walters. She was living in the 80s and asking questions that seemed very normal back then. But looking back, I do think it wasn't normal, you know, to ask a 15-year-old if her mother wasn't doing the right job and what are your measurements? I don't think I've ever asked anybody what your measurements are if I want to know how tall you are, you know? Measurements No. means boobs, waist, and hips, doesn't it?
It does, and it's really objectifying this little girl. But, you know, I do also have to say, yeah, because I started modeling in 1980, and I was 15, and, you know, there was a different sort of mental attitude about this. I recall people being slightly shocked about me being 15 at times, but the things that were said to me at 15 were far worse than what Barbara said to Brooke. You know, that's just your, you know, that's your public interview. But, you know, what's said to you as you walk in on a set, and when you're walking off a set, and when you're asked to take your clothes off or, you know, change clothes. And I mean, you know, a model is an object to a certain extent. And so you're treated as one, whether you listen or not, that's, you know, that really doesn't matter. But as an object, you know, it's funny. It's almost like, people forget that you can hear and that you can understand language. And so they will
right.
just...
I'm right here. I can hear you, yeah. right? But you know, I will say this, both you and Brooke, whatever was going on, you both turned out pretty remarkably given the you know bizarre circumstances you all lived through and the weird stuff that you shouldn't have. And I'm always thankful that you just come and talk to me, period. And it's time for us to have that Christmas drink in Manhattan.
I know. I'm still holding you up to it.
Paulina Poroskova, thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, there's somebody else who I adore as much as I adore Paulina, and that's Gail King. And she's got some amazing advice for how to keep your cool at the office, even when your office looks like this.
Stop it. Y'all quit playing. Quit playing. Robert. I didn't do this stuff. This is not me. Y'all, I'm fighting for my life. Y'all killing me with this.
Yeah, so I had a chance to talk to Gail in a mentoring symposium today. She kicked off that with some amazing comments about that interview and about her career and just how she has gone as far as she has. You're going to get some of the secrets next. So today I did something that I've been wanting to do for years and years. I launched an initiative called Rising Tide, the Value in Mentoring Others. And it's all about getting big, important people who have risen to the top in broadcasting to join me for a Zoom with hundreds of people who are getting started so that they can ask questions of the big guy and hopefully avoid some of the hurdles and pratfalls that tripped us up along the way. So I kicked it off with Gail King because Gail... And I love her. Plus, she's just that person who is so pure and honest and authentic that it's really served her well all the way along her career. And she's had a career that a lot of people didn't know about. Long time in local news, 18 years at a Hartford station as local anchor, number of other local stations along the way. And then this phenomenal experience as an editor at Oprah Magazine, and then, of course, on CBS Mornings, where she is now. And so the questions came in from the audience, and Gail, nothing was off limits. Love that. So I wanted to play some of it for you, especially the thing about the R. Kelly interview and how she was able to maintain that kind of calm, because anybody else in my business, me included, would have freaked out a bit while R. Kelly was, you know, coming at you. Fisted like that. But she had an amazing answer for it. So take a look at this little back and forth between us.
How do you manage to keep your emotions maintained when reporting on heartbreaking news? And I'm going to add to that, how do you keep your emotions contained when it gets real in front of you? Like with R. Kelly, you were so incredibly poised. I don't know anybody who could have pulled it off the way you did. How did you do it? And what's in you that makes you capable?
Well, I think part of that comes with experience. If that had happened to me, early in my career, I think I would have been very rattled, no question. I would have been very rattled by it, but I felt very well prepared. I also knew that I wasn't done with the interview. I still had more questions for Mr. Kelly, also known as Robert. I had more questions for him. And I looked at interviews with him, and I saw that when he got rattled or he didn't like something, he would get up and leave the room. And so my intention was to do everything I could to make sure he didn't leave. And so if I'd responded in kind to him the way he responded in me, the interview would have been over. If I had tried to comfort him or I had tried to soothe him, the interview would have been over. So I just thought, let me make no sudden moves, look up, look down, look up, look down. And I was looking at him and looking at the chair, looking at him, looking at the chair, letting him know that whenever, whatever this is, whatever you're doing here, I'm not going anywhere. And he saw that. And I didn't know him. I didn't know R. Kelly, but I never thought that I was in danger, even though he was very angry. I didn't think that I was in danger.
I thought I watched you. I thought she's not even flinching and he's sort of coming at her physically.
No, you know, that's the thing. I didn't think he was coming at me. He was mad and with every word, he was emphasizing every word with his fist. I thought he could accidentally hit me, which would have hurt. I was a little nervous about that. But I didn't think that he would ever intentionally hit me. I called the next day to check on him with his team, and they said that he was actually appreciative and was thanking me for giving him a chance to show his passion and his pain. He was not even angry about it. He was not even angry about it. I think you were watching somebody, in my opinion, who became unglued in that moment. People said, oh, he was acting, he was playing you. I didn't feel that at all.
So there are a few other questions that our audience had for Gail. If you follow Gail on Instagram, she's just so out there. She will wear a bathing suit and she will step on the scale, something that women in television have never done and still really struggle with doing. But to Gail, no biggie. And so it was great when some of the questions came in about bosses and confines and being a woman in broadcasting. And so here's how this back and forth went. Take a look.
Quick question before I get to the participants, and that is, how do you navigate bosses that are difficult?
I think, knock on wood, I've been pretty fortunate. I haven't had anybody that I thought was really outrageous. I can remember in Connecticut, after I had my first baby, favorite daughter, Kirby, and, you know, when you get pregnant, you tend to gain weight. And when you have the baby, I took it as a license to eat. So I gained quite a bit of weight. And I went into his office because he said he wanted to talk to me about something. And it's not like I was looking at his desk, Ashley, but there's something about your name catches your eye. You know, if it's written down on a piece of paper, I swear to God, I wasn't looking at his desk, but there were papers there. I happened to glance down and I saw my name and I thought, my name was, and next to my name, it said Gail's butt. And I thought, now what is this going? What could this possibly mean? And so he's fricking frack back and forth. You're doing such a great job. You were so happy you had a baby and Kirby, blah, 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 blah. And he goes, but, you know, I do have to say, Gail, you know, when they take those wide shots on the side and you're at the end, your butt hangs over your chair. So do you think that maybe you could, you know, scoot in a little bit? I didn't even know what to say to that. I mean, so what did I say? Okay.
You know, but we did.
Nowadays, I would have a different answer. But back then, all I could say was, okay. And I walked out of the office going, what the hell did he just say?
And then with, you know, age comes wisdom, because I've been at this game 34 years and Gail's been at it a long time too. And she and I laughed about some of the things we thought were normal back then and would not stand for today. But many of the participants, and there were a couple hundred, they were a little older too, starting in this career. And I got this great question from one of the journalists in the audience who had started a little later in her life and wanted some advice from Gail. Have a look.
So this one says, I started my career as a reporter 2 days after my 40th birthday. What advice do you have for someone starting in this field later in life rather than starting early in their 20s? Great question.
I think that is a great question, because I got my job at CBS. I was close to 60 when I got that job. And who would have thought, you know, who would have thought at that stage in my life, in my career, that I would even be offered something at the network? So I put no value or no burden in age. I really do believe age is just a number. I do think that 40 is unusual to be starting as a reporter. I will acknowledge that, but I don't think that it's a barrier. There's a great book out now called Roar by Michael Clinton, who happens to be, I used to work with him here at Hearst. I'm at the offices of Oprah Daily. I have another job here. Michael Clinton was one of our top publishers, and he says, people shouldn't focus on age appropriate. They should focus on person appropriate. And I think that is the best advice of all. Keep in mind, Walter Cronkite had to retire from CBS at the age of 65, Ashley. I'm 66. So I wouldn't even be at CBS News if we still had those antiquated rules.
And I think back when I started, I don't know that I would have had a career at 66. It's pretty tricky. There were this many women, and maybe that many still exist, but boy, oh boy. So this last one I want you to hear is about why we did this anyway. This mentoring session, Rising Tide, it's important because it's what John F. Kennedy said. It lifts all boats, okay? The value in mentoring others, it lifts you too. So it's a great thing to do if you're out there. It doesn't have to be in media, of course, but help others because you will be better. Believe it or not, it's magic, whether it's karma or whatever you want to ascribe to it. And Gail had something great to say about that. This really does take a village to do well in this business. It's a team sport. Here's what she had to say about that.
6 months into my first full-time anchor job in a newsroom, where for the first time, I'm one of the older, more experienced people, so it had me wondering, did mentoring and making the time for it naturally happen as your career evolved, or was there a point in your career where you became very intentional about it? Awesome question. I love it.
I just know, Ashley, that nobody makes it alone. I just know along the way, somebody has to help you. I don't care who you are. Somebody has to help you. Somebody has to give you a break. Somebody has to see something in you that maybe you didn't see in yourself. And so whenever anybody is really serious and wants to know about this business, I do take the time. I remember the people that were helpful to me. You never forget Ralph Begleiter, Pam Coulter, J.C. Hayward. To this day, I can still remember their names. Bruce Johnson. I can still remember those people that helped me. So when I see somebody who really wants to know about this business, and not for nothing, I love what we get to do. I still love this friggin' job. So
that's fun.
I think so. I say all the time, we have a front row seat to history and we get to tell people about it. I think that's very cool. It's a big responsibility and it's a big privilege at the same time. So when she says you're the only one that answered me or one of two, I don't know who that is, because I do that a lot to people who I think are really serious about wanting to know about this business.
She's great. And that you can go to the website and you can see her whole session. It's newsnationnow.com/risingtide. And guess what? You can be a part of it. January 12th, our next VIP mentor is Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN chief medical correspondent, real-life neurosurgeon, also host of the podcast Chasing Life. Can't wait for that. January 12th, 3 p.m. Eastern. Register now. Go to newsnationnow.com/risingtide. Or just Google Rising Tide and Ashley. You'll get there. When we come back after the break, did you check your calendar? It's an important day. It's a really important day. I'm going to let you know why next. It is December 7th, and if you can believe it, 80 years ago today, Pearl Harbor was attacked, the day that will live in infamy, that catapulted the United States into World War II. 2,390 Americans were lost that day. So as you close off your day, thank somebody who served, honor them in your own way, and remember, these anniversaries are important. Thanks for being here. See you tomorrow.